It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly On Congress segment. USA Today Politics and Congress editor Paul Singer will give us an update on what's happening in our nation's capital this week.
But first, a new bill in Wisconsin would make it illegal to give out false information about elections. It's called the Honest Elections Bill, and Democratic State Representative Mandela Barnes unveiled it this afternoon.
Representative Barnes is with us to explain how this bill would change existing election law and why it's necessary here in Wisconsin. He's a Democrat from Milwaukee. He represents the 11th Assembly District. Representative Barnes, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me this afternoon.
How would this bill change existing election law here in Wisconsin?
Well, what the bill would do is it would criminalize the activity of providing false or misleading information intentionally to deceive voters or to manipulate outcomes in whatever area that you're exercising this practice in. Currently, it's not a law on the book, but it will put the act of purposely providing false information on par with regular voter fraud activity. Essentially, it would add this as an infraction.
What kind of false information are we talking about, saying come to the election on Tuesday the 4th and the election's really on the 11th or giving the wrong polling place? Is that the kind of thing you're looking at?
There's absolutely been instances like this, and I've seen personally in my days as an organizer where there will be times in low voter turnout areas, typically where we see the fall-off voters, people who don't vote in every single election, people who come out for the big ones, whether it's for the president or for a governor's race, what you will sometimes see is people who say, well, due to high expected turnout, I mean, there's been flyers that said due to high expected turnout, you'll be allowed to vote Wednesday also, so don't waste your time standing in line. There's been instances, even I've had conversations with my friends in other states who are legislators, and they talked about times where there's been robocalls to specific houses of people who aren't regular voters providing the same type of false information. And one person even said they've gone so far as to skip the robocalls and have live dialers calling people, telling them that they can vote on another day or even vote by phone. And even also in the recall election, there were instances where people said, well, if you sign the recall, that means you don't have to go vote because that is your vote. And, you know, some people fell for that information, or some people, you know, decide, hey, let me give this another look, and told someone about it, and then were, you know, instructed otherwise that this is not the case. I mean, it's not to attack any one party at all. It's not just if you vote Democrat or if you vote Republican, your vote should be protected. This is for people all across the entire state of Wisconsin.
So these are things I think people would usually think of as dirty tricks, trying to keep people from voting or having them show up the wrong day or time. This isn't currently illegal, you say?
Right.
So what would the penalty be if this bill passed?
So this would be a Class I felony, as is any other type of voter fraud. Meaning that it could be up to 3.5 years or a $10,000 fortune, or excuse me, forfeiture. This would be and or. I mean, that's obviously the maximum, but it would the same charges that were the same penalty that's on the books for a voter fraud conviction will be the same charge that you would receive for potentially taking away someone's right to franchise. And you know, it's a supreme right; it should be protected. It's the great equalizer between the rich and the poor, whatever race you are, religion, sexual orientation, gender, you have one vote, and you shouldn't have that vote compromised by anyone.
As far as you know, is this the first time we've seen a legislative effort to tackle these tactics?
So I'm not aware in the state of Wisconsin of legislative action being attempted. Again, I had a chance to speak with some of my fellow legislative colleagues from other states a while last summer, and it was an issue that they talked about.
And speaking of legislative colleagues, you unveiled this today, but have you sought out opinions from your colleagues in the Wisconsin state legislature to see if there's a chance this thing could pass?
Well, I've absolutely. We sent this out for co-sponsorship memo or for co-sponsorship And they're, you know, I'll be in Madison tomorrow. I'll absolutely be speaking to some of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle specifically about it. Again, it's not a partisan bill by any means. It's something that's equal in application, equal in penalty. And I think that it's sort of a no-brainer. I think that we all can agree that people shouldn't have their right to franchise tampered with.
Are you hoping that, in part, that having this law in existence would be kind of a, I guess, a deterrent for people doing this in the first place? Maybe the punishment wouldn't have to be applied that often if people knew it was there?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely a deterrent. People should know that this is not acceptable behavior in any democracy, not just the state of Wisconsin, just any democracy in general.
And do you think having a law like this on the books, what would it do for people's confidence in elections here in the state?
Well, I think it absolutely helps. But, you know, and for people to know that, you know, it's unlawful for people to provide them false information, I think it does a lot to the confidence of voters. And I, you know, personally, I wish people voted in every election. I think that civic participation is very important, but for one reason or another, some people only come out for certain elections, and not being a regular voter, when that time passes in between those big elections, you know, you may fall for someone saying that, hey, the rules have changed since you were here 2 years ago. The rules have changed since you were here 4 years ago. So,
is this a way to do it, by punishing people who do these things, or would it be smarter to do more with voter education, get the accurate news out there and make sure the public is aware of their rights and how they vote?
Well, voter education is still huge. That piece has to happen, but there has to be both sides of the coin. I don't think that, you know, if we're gonna talk about, you know, voter fraud being an issue, I mean, voter education would also solve that problem. But if there's a law in the books that is to deter voter fraud by penalty, then there should also be a law that deters the other form of voter fraud by penalty.
So before we let you go, I want to get your perspective from the vantage of a legislator from Milwaukee. What other things do you think could be done, apart from this legislation, to increase voter turnout, increase people's confidence, increase the sense of enfranchisement in Wisconsin politics?
Mm-hmm. So I think the voter turnout is on an individual basis, but what we've seen in the last few elections, even in 2010, we saw a higher turnout was higher than usual in fall 2010 when the recall came around. There were record numbers in wards that did not traditionally turn out. And in this last presidential election, we had record numbers in the city of Milwaukee. I think that people obviously they see the importance of these larger elections. However, the importance of the smaller elections, the more local elections, is not immediately known. And I think that a better effort to get people out, get people energized and excited to come out of the house to vote for these local elections, people to understand the consequences of those elections. People understood the consequences of a gubernatorial race. People saw what happened even when they turned out for the recall. You know, people were disappointed, they were energized, and they had a specific reason to go out and vote in record numbers. And then the presidential races, I mean, obviously going to bring out higher numbers than our local elections anyway.
Representative Barnes, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. It's a great time.
That was Representative Mandela Barnes. He's a Democrat from Milwaukee. He represents the 11th Assembly District. We were talking about the Honest Election Bill he unveiled earlier today. It's time for our weekly look at Congress. Last week, we considered changes in the new Farm Bill. That bill has now passed both houses, passed the Senate yesterday, and it's being sent to President Obama for a signature. If you missed that discussion, you can check it out on Central Times page at WPR.org.
Well, on the table this week, the debt limit suspension that reopened the government last October expires on Friday, and the Treasury is expected to run out of money around the end of the month.
The federal deficit has also fallen dramatically. We'll see what that means for Congress. Here with us is Paul Singer, Congress and Politics editor at USA Today. He joins us every Wednesday at this time to catch us up on one of America's most disliked legislatures in history. Paul, always good to have you with us.
Nice to be here. Nice intro.
Well, and in that intro, we mentioned the government shutdown and reopened last October. Okay, and we were done worrying about debt ceilings and so forth until Friday, when the debt limit suspension, I gather, expires. Are we back again where we started?
It's funny. We were not expecting to be back where we started. The theory was, as of about 10 days ago, Republicans didn't want to have this fight again. They think the shutdown affected them badly. They have lost some leverage because government funding for the year has already been approved. So, you know, they don't really want to default on debt, on the nation's debt. They don't want to be blamed for it. So the assumption was they were going to just sort of allow this one to pass. Well, the problem is that there is not consensus within the Republican conference about what to do. There are a handful of sort of Tea Party and ideologically conservative deficit hawks, I guess you'd call them, or debt hawks in this case, who really just don't want to raise the debt and don't want to vote yes. So the question is, are there enough votes to pass the thing? And they're just not sure. And they're also not sure, the Republicans, whether there's anything they can do to sort of negotiate something that will make their members happy. Because the Obama administration has said, basically, we're not going to negotiate it at all. Pass it, up or down.
So any chance this will be taken care of by Friday?
No.
Short answer.
No. House isn't going to vote this week. Next week is a little murky because it's possible the Senate could take this thing up and pass it clean, just, you know, debt limit clean, and then leave it to the House to go figure out what to do with it. But the House, next week, Democrats take off for a couple of days for a conference of their own to plan their strategies. So there's not a lot of time next week either. It won't get done pretty clearly this week, and it won't get done. Well, if it's going to get done next week, it better be done by this time next week.
But wait a minute. The deadline's this Friday, so the government doesn't shut down this Friday. It's not. It's kind of a softish deadline, huh?
Yeah, you and your deadline. No, the way the debt ceiling works is basically at that point, we are now sort of at the limit of what we're allowed to borrow. But there is wiggle room. There are what they call extraordinary measures the Treasury Department can take. For instance, they can stop making some payments, or at least suspend making some payments to long-term pension funds, stuff like that. There is stuff they can do to wiggle around. They will tell you, and they have told Congress, they have much less wiggle room this time than they had last time. And the reason is tax season has begun. And so the Treasury's outflow of cash increases significantly. Basically, they start paying off all the tax returns they owe. So hundreds of billions of dollars flow out. They don't have a lot of money to monkey around with.
But it sounds as though we shouldn't be chewing our nails too badly. We're not going to get into a situation we were last October.
I don't think so. I'm not convinced this is going to become the kind of showdown that was. Because nobody really has an incentive to make that happen. I mean, even if they just figure out a way to, you know, punt it for a couple of months, that would be better. So we'll see. I'm not at this moment suggesting that anybody run for the hills.
Staying on the topic of money, the federal deficit we're reading has fallen pretty significantly. That the deficit's the annual shortfall, the debt is the running tally, so the debt is still going up. But does that decrease in the deficit change anything?
Well, I mean, it's a nice thing for the Democrats to be able to say that deficits are shrinking. One of the reasons that deficits are shrinking is that the economy is improving, so tax revenue is going up. Another reason that deficits are shrinking is because, you remember the fiscal cliff a year ago? Part of that whole fiasco was what amounted to a very large tax increase. Particularly on wealthy people. So then you have, again, tax revenue goes up, deficits go down. It's kind of funny. You guys up in Wisconsin, I think your governor announced $1 billion surplus, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do have a surplus here. They're figuring out what to do with it in Wisconsin.
Yeah, same deal. The reason they got a surplus is because tax revenues increased over what they anticipated because the economy was getting better. So, you know, it's just the basic math that when the economy gets stronger and tax revenue increases, you've got more of it. You can pay down your deficits, or in some cases, actually bank up surpluses. To the degree it trends that way, it'll be very good for the Democrats to be able to say, hey, look, we're getting closer to a balanced budget.
So the rhetoric around the deficit has been pretty intense in the past several years. With this new news in hand, is how we talk about the deficit, is that going to change?
Nah, not really. I mean, because keep in mind, Republicans can still say, okay, well, let's cut spending to keep driving the debt down, the long-term debt down. Second of all, you know, all right, our deficit is down to $500 billion. Well, that's good, but, you know, that's still real money in some people's accounting. And I think it's still – I think that even with improving deficit numbers, we are still very clearly in a time of austerity. You know, we have come to a point where we have to realize – and I think the budget agreement that they agreed to late last year, earlier this year, you know, is really intended to stake out a position that is more fiscally responsible, more fiscally conservative, less spending – regardless of the deficit numbers, the year-to-year deficit numbers.
Well, let's turn to Congress's role, and I guess more specifically the Senate's role in foreign policy. The U.S. struck a deal with Iran last November during the nuclear talks. There's been tension over what to do about sanctions in Congress, and the president applying pressure, saying, watch out for those sanctions, it's going to ruin what we're talking about with Iran. What's the latest in Congress with that?
I know absolutely nothing about foreign policy. I'm proud of that. What I do know about Congress is that they, at the moment, appear to be willing to see whether these talks with Iran are going to make progress. There have been some hopeful signs. There have been some indications that, in fact, Iran may be willing to make moves towards stepping down their nuclear program. That's good. And the White House can say, and said to Congress fairly clearly, give us time to let this work before we start talking about new sanctions in Iran. And for the moment, at least, it looks like Congress has been willing to say, well, okay. I'm not sure they have a whole lot to gain, honestly, in Congress from trying to push a new sanctions bill now. You know, why... as long as the headlines coming out of Iran are decent, why push your luck? Because it won't be hard for them to pass it as soon as it becomes clear that Iran is not serious. It won't be hard for them to pass new sanctions.
Well, let's move from foreign policy back to home turf. States and municipalities have been increasingly crafting their own legislation on marijuana. It doesn't look like President Obama is planning to block anything, but is Congress going to do anything when it comes to stepping in when states decide to go their own way?
It's really interesting. You know, it's a hard nut for Congress to crack. They don't necessarily have a lot of authority here. In fact, if you wanted to have the federal government crack down on states that are loosening penalties for marijuana, you would have to make the argument that the states' rights don't prevail, which is in some cases a religious argument in Congress, right? There are people who are very, very committed to states' rights and who argue that, in fact, the federal government has overstepped its bounds. And not to sort of, you know, throw the whole ball of social hot buttons at you at once, but if you want to say that states should be allowed to, for instance, ban gay marriage, then what if states want to ban gay marriage but allow marijuana? You know, I mean, it's a tough issue for Congress to get into that way when the states are deciding to do stuff on their own. There's also, I'm not sure they got a whole lot of authority, right? They could, I guess they could pass another bill saying, you know, the Justice Department shall enforce federal law even where the states are not being helpful. But I don't know if they're going to make much progress on that front. At the moment, I think watching the states play this out themselves is really where it's going to lie.
All right. I don't know if I'm surprising you here with this. I saw a couple pieces of news today. Two new likely candidates for Congress, American Idol star Clay Aiken, Saturday Night Live veteran Victoria Jackson, Democrat and Republican respectively. Will more celebrities in Congress make your job more fun?
Yeah, totally. Although not necessarily. Like, we thought Al Franken was going to be the greatest thing to happen. You know, he was going to come and be hilarious. But it, he has avoided us, the national press, like we're plagued. He barely talks to us at all. And he's almost never funny. We got to go find other people to make us laugh. It's always great to have, you know, your celebrity congressperson wander down the hall. I was here when Cooter was here.
From the Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah, and Gopher from the Love Boat. You know, we always enjoyed that.
All right, something to look forward to. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, we'll talk to you guys later.
That was Congress and Politics editor at USA Today, Paul Singer. He joins us each Wednesday at this time to talk Congress.
The Winter Olympics in Sochi are just around the corner. The opening ceremony isn't until Friday, but some qualifying events are taking place tomorrow.
And while the Olympics are often a time of excitement and inspiration, these games have been overshadowed in part by concerns over security and terrorism, to the point where those concerns have caused one Wisconsin Olympian to tell his family to stay home. What's behind these threats, and how is Russian President Putin planning on keeping his country and the world's athletes safe for the next 2 weeks?
Joining us now to make sense of the security threat is Lisa Baglione, professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph's University. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start by having you set the stage. And we're hearing a lot about potential terror threats and the twin bombings in the town of Volgograd last month put the world on watch, effectively. Who's behind this?
Well, we think it's the Caucasus Emirate, and they are a group that emerged out of the unrest in Chechnya and the rest of the North Caucasus, and that's rooted in two earlier wars, one that started in end of 1994 and a second that resumed in 1999. And what we saw is in 2007, a more radical group emerged to announce this being the Caucasus Emirate, and to take action in a jihadist or Islamist fashion to fight Russians, especially. But then they have expanded their concerns to Western interests too.
Now, there have been security experts quoted in the papers recently saying that the threats that we know about so far, that they're credible. What do we know so far about the threats?
Well, back in July, the leader of the Caucasus Emirate, Doku Umarov, said that group would take actions to disrupt the Olympics. And then we have seen their activity in October and in December aimed at Volgograd. And so the fear is that they will attack not only Sochi or potentially different parts of Russia, and in that sense make people nervous and also cause death and destruction. They have been very successful in doing that, as we saw just in December. But for the last 6 years, they've wreaked a lot of havoc on Russians.
Now, terror threats at the Olympics, unfortunately, they're not a new thing anymore. Mm-hmm. Do we have reason to take the threats at Sochi more seriously than other threats in the past?
Well, I think we have to take these threats very seriously, because this group has announced an intention and has succeeded in the past. We can't just look at Sochi, or the Russians can't just look at Sochi, that they would consider be acting in other parts of Russia and potentially in other parts of the world, although their reach is as far as we know, less capable. But as you may know in some of the things that you have read, some people believe that the Boston bombers, marathon bombers, were, if not affiliated, trying to impress or had been inspired by this group to take action and to show their commitment and seriousness. So these threats are serious, and the Russian government takes them seriously, and other governments of the world do. And it is a big concern.
We're hearing a lot about a so-called ring of steel that will protect Sochi, including some pretty extraordinary measures. Can you describe some of the precautions in place to keep Sochi safe?
Well, certainly. The Russian government invested, I think it's about $2 billion to close off the city, and brought in about 100,000 people, which is 4 times the amount of officers who were at the London Olympics in 2012 to maintain security. The area was cordoned off a few months ago, and also we have the governor of that area recommissioning the Cossacks, which is an unofficial group of people on horseback who will use actions to look for potential terrorists. But the issue is not just quantity, but it's going to be the quality of what they can deliver. And here there are some concerns, because if we look at, for instance, just how the Russians were able to fight the war in Georgia, which is related in terms of Russians' activity, they have problems with command, control, communications, and intelligence and surveillance. So what we worry about now is whether there's going to be the kind of information sharing, and then ability to act. Another thing about these forces is that they're split with the FSB, that's the Federal Security Service, as those in charge, but the folks who are mostly implementing are from a different service, the Interior Ministry and the police. And we've had long-standing inter-service rivalries, and so that could be an issue too. So Russia's preparations in numbers of people are, one could say, unprecedented. The issue is whether the delivery will be there. And what's so hard is in a group like this, the Caucasus Emirate, it's relatively small. The estimates are about 400 to 1,500 active fighters, but they tend to be very self-contained, linked by family or clan relationships. And so some folks I've been reading say that the best way to break up or to foil a plot is to have inside information. And these groups are very hard to get inside, number one. And number two, the Russian forces haven't been that successful in infiltrating. So the concern is, for terrorism to succeed, it takes one motivated person, two motivated people to make it through that ring of steel. And particularly with the quality of Russian forces, with the reputation of some of those troops, it is a bit of a worry.
The United States, though, has not been leaving security entirely up to the Russians. We have a private security firm in place called Tiger Swan. Mm-hmm. I understand that there is an aircraft carrier standing by in the Black Sea. Can you talk a little bit about those efforts?
Well, I'm not quite sure what the U.S. aircraft carrier is going to be able to accomplish. Perhaps if there is a disaster, yes, it can airlift people out. But it seems it's a bit, I wonder if that's just playing to our domestic politics. And so that, you know, it is a measure of prevention, or not prevention, of for disaster planning. I don't know what it can do to actually prevent. You need people on the ground. With respect to the security forces, they can keep individual athletes or groups of athletes safe. But the question is, how good are their language skills? How well are they integrated into the Russian efforts, so that they would be able to share information or coordinate with the Russians? And I'm just not sure that there's been the planning, the training, and other activities to make it a success.
Now, is Russia in a tough place right now, in that it has to balance its need to stay secure and the need to project an image of a non-military state to the rest of the world?
Sure, and that's part of one of the whole reason for having and hosting this Olympics. For Putin, these Sochi Olympics are intended to be this crowning achievement, an achievement to show that Russia is back. Russia, there, and it's back in two ways. You have to think of from the Russian perspective, the 1990s are this disaster decade, a decade of losing their empire, losing their imperial glory, and economic depression, and therefore the lack of losing respect both in at home and abroad. And the 2000s and Putin's narrative about the 2000s is what he has done is remake Russian power, remake Russian prestige, and the Russian economy. So he has restored respect. And so the Olympics were supposed to focus on all of these wonderful positives and to show off this beautiful city that was going to be remade and made so with these amazing interconnections between the temperate climate and the mountains for the snow. But now, as I think we all know, all the reports have come out, there are just so many questions about how well Putin is going to be able to deliver on what he had hoped for.
Well, and let's talk more about the Russian president. How much is riding on these games for Vladimir Putin?
Well, for Putin, end of 2011 and 2012 were very difficult years for him. He had, when he and Medvedev announced that they were going to switch posts again, and then the elections, the legislative elections went forward in December, there were protests. People protested the stealing of the elections, the corruption in the elections, and then people continued to protest into the presidential campaign, which was held in March. This was a shock to him, and it made his prestige decrease nationally and internationally. Thereafter, he's been working very hard to rebuild, and he's had some great successes. In 2013 was a year of big success, and again, he can build this narrative, and he was hoping to bring that into the Sochi Olympics. So he's the great, he stands up for freedom and rights with giving Edward Snowden asylum. He's the mediator that keeps the U.S. and the West from attacking Syria, and he helps to put the chemical weapons Syria to give up its chemical weapons. And then at the end of the year, he influences the Ukraine to not move forward with its arrangement with the EU and to strengthen its relationship with Russia. So and I forgot, of course, his Man of the Year designation by the Times in Times
so
International.
It's a complex picture.
So yes. So the Sochi Olympics were supposed to be his crowning achievement, put those worries behind him, and to move him forward back onto the world stage.
Elisa, do you think the Olympic Committee knew what they were in for in terms of the security challenge when they picked Sochi?
Well, I read the New York Times this morning too. They should have, but it sounds as if they were charmed by Mr. Putin, and it's, you know, I'm not sure how well the Olympic Committee follows developments in the North Caucasus or did back then. And again, the narrative that Putin was using over the mid-2000s and on was that the war in Chechnya was basically over. The problem of terrorism was, for the most part, contained. He had turned the responsibility for the war primarily over to local groups in Chechnya. He called it the Chechenization of the war. So this was before the Olympic Committee would have made its decision. I think that the Olympic Committee wasn't following these politics as well as it could have.
Well, we'll be watching along with the world. Lisa, thank you so much for helping us get a handle on this today.
It's My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking about what's behind the terror threat in Sochi with Elisa Baglione, professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph's University.
Now we want to hear your thoughts on the Olympics. There's been a lot of negative news surrounding the Sochi Olympics, as we just heard, security issues and threats of terror. Also concerns about corruption, shortfalls in infrastructure, international protests over human rights issues and an anti-gay law in Russia. Just a few of the stories casting a shadow. All that in the pot. Are you going to watch the Olympics? Is that going to steer you away? Or will you set the politics aside and watch the game? If so, what are you looking forward to? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@WPR.org.
We're taking your calls right now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Are you planning on tuning into the Olympics, or has the negative news, a terror threat surrounding the games, has it turned you off from watching? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to the phones now. We've got Renee with us in East Troy. Renee, hi.
Hi. I was on Twitter last night or this morning, and there are some very humorous photos. The reporters that are arriving now in Sochi, like there were some reporters from CNN, they had booked 11 rooms at a hotel, but only one room was ready. What are you supposed to do? And things like the water doesn't work if there is any water, and the hotel doesn't have a lobby. One of the signs... These are reporters that are tweeting these photos. The sign in the room said, don't drink the water or use it on your face because it has dangerous particles in it. And then she took a photo of the water, and it was brown. So I'm just saying the hotel, I mean, Putin promised all these hotel rooms, but they're not ready yet. And the workmen are working 24 hours a day to get it done. But meanwhile, I don't know what these reporters are doing.
All right, Renee, thanks for the call, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you going to watch the Olympics? Why or why not? What are you looking forward to?
All right, thanks for that call, and let's go next to Anita in Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, Anita.
Hi. First of all, I will be watching the Olympics, no matter where they held them. However, there's a huge question among so many people. I mean, every time I talk to somebody, everybody keeps shrugging their shoulders and going, why are we choosing Sochi for this? First of all, it doesn't have a winter climate. It has a climate like that of Atlanta, Georgia. And this is not, I'm not kidding, this is true. And so that means they're transporting the Olympians that need snow to the mountains. And they said, and if there's not enough snowfall, they have a whole bunch of it stockpiled that they can truck in. Between that and the security, one wonders, what was the criteria? Who judged that Sochi was going to be the best spot for our Olympics this year?
So knowing what you know, all of the things that you just said, is it going to get in the way of you enjoying the Winter Olympics, do you think?
I think that the threats, that the terrorist threats that we've known about, that makes you a little tense. It's sort of like watching, the Stanley Cup playoffs, and it's, sudden death. Only in this case it really would be. So it does make you a little tense.
All right, Anita, thank you so much for calling and sharing your thoughts.
A line just opened up at 800-642-1234. Share your thoughts why you are or aren't watching the Olympics. 800-642-1234. We'll go to Catherine in Oshkosh next. Catherine, hi there.
Hi. I disagree with the previous caller. Excuse me. These young people are fellow Americans, and they have worked really hard for this. And they are taking the chance to be able to go there and risk everything to be able to compete. And I seriously believe that if everybody felt that same way, they would watch, regardless of the rhetoric. And I guess, what's going on in Russia in terms of, the hotels and stuff, it's comical. But that should have no effect or any bearing on whether or not we watch these young people and support them.
So it's about the athletes for you, Catherine. What events are you particularly excited to see in the Winter Olympics?
I love the ice skating. So that, and I'm kind of fascinated with the snowboarding.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, that's Those are primarily what I will be watching.
All right, Catherine, thanks so much for your call. You can join in, just a couple minutes left. Your thoughts on the Olympics. What news are you watching? What has you worried? What has you excited? And the big question, are you going to watch the Olympics? Do you ever? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234. Veronica, I know our own Cynthia Schuster is a huge, huge figure skating fan. I imagine she'll be watching that this year. Is it an event that you tend to follow in the Winter Olympics?
I actually like the figure skating, too, and the ice dancing. I like snow, which is ironic, considering I don't like snow as much in Wisconsin as I like it when it's on TV. But I mean, there's a lot. But it's a complex scenario we're in right now, and I think our callers are reflecting that, talking about some ambivalencies about watching it, some saying, yeah, let's support the athletes. Some people are saying, you know, sure, I'm going to watch, but I'm not sure that this was the best call to make. So people are expressing mixed feelings about this year's Olympics. And let's take another caller now. We have Kim on the line from Hartford. Hi, Kim.
Hi there.
Hi. What do you think about this year's Olympics? Will you be watching?
Actually, no, I'm going to boycott it this year.
Okay. How come?
Actually, there was a mass killing of the stray dogs in that area. Just for the event.
Okay, so that's enough to keep you away. There's lots of other things, and if it weren't for that, would you be watching?
Oh, I still wouldn't watch. Not with the other things that are going on as well. I think it was a very poor choice.
Okay, well, thank you for calling and sharing your thoughts. Appreciate it.
We'll go now to Henry in Algoma. Henry, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I'm calling about the Olympics. I'm interested in the luge and bobsled, considering there's no snow and they got to ship everybody up there. I'm curious about that. And I'm also curious about, I'm afraid something's going to happen.
All right.
And,
Henry, thanks for sharing your thoughts. Luge is an exciting one to watch. Definitely the bobsled. It probably is fun to watch, but I think it would be pretty terrifying to do. I always wonder about that. Thanks for sharing that, Henry. I think we have time for one more caller if we get somebody queued up. Looking at Dino in Mount Horeb. Dino, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, everyone. Just want to say thanks for awesome programming again. I am looking forward to the magical spectacle that is the Winter Olympics. Going back to the first Olympics that I was old enough to understand and comprehend, and how excited I got staying up all night watching the NBC coverage from Sarajevo when it was then Yugoslavia. And I think it's a point to be made that we don't know what the future is going to hold for these various venues that host these games. And given the state of geopolitics on that side of the world, it's going to be interesting to see if the games have any impact in bringing together.
All right. Thanks a lot. We'll leave it there. Dino, thanks to you and for everyone for their calls and comments.